A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's latest prompt lands on something that's been quietly building for weeks now. The National Security Council put Egypt, including Sinai, at level 4, same tier as Jordan, Qatar, and Somaliland, must be strictly avoided. And Daniel's asking the question underneath the warning, how much control has Egypt actually solidified over the peninsula? What ISIS groups are still active, and whether the survival of whatever remains owes something to people who've known that terrain from birth. He also points out the tension that makes this weird for Israelis specifically. Sinai is the backyard holiday destination, Taba Crossing, 14 days visa-free, drive down the coast to Dahab or Nuaiba. And yet the same peninsula hosted the deadliest terror attack in Egyptian history.
311 people in a Sufi mosque at Bir al-Abed. November 2017. That number still doesn't sit right with me. You've got worshippers in a remote northern Sinai town, and gunmen with explosives arrived during Friday prayers. The scale of it, and the fact that it targeted other Muslims, that was the moment a lot of people inside Egypt stopped treating the insurgency as something the army could just grind through.
And the army did grind. Sisi declared the end of terrorism in North Sinai in January 2023. Operation Martyr's Rite formally concluded. The question Daniel's really asking is whether that declaration describes the ground or describes the government's preferred version of it.
I think the honest answer is somewhere in the middle, and the CASS Center analysis from late June actually put it cleanly. Sinai is in relative security stability compared to 2014 through 2020, but that reflects a transition from intensive military confrontation to managing residual threats, not eradication, managing. The desert's expanse and geography provide an environment that remaining elements may exploit to reorganize or carry out limited operations. That's the language of people who know the thing isn't over.
Managing residual threats is a very polite way to say the cells are still there, but nobody wants to call them ISIS anymore.
Well, the formal structure is gone. Islamic State Sinai Province, Wilayat Sinai, was active from November 2014 until 2023. Before that, it was Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, which pledged allegiance to al-Baghdadi. The U.S. National Counterterrorism Center says the branch has been in decline since at least 2022. Egypt arrested or killed many members. Others accepted amnesty. The formal organization conducted more than 500 attacks in Sinai between 2014 and 2022, mostly against Egyptian security forces. By 2023, the branch appeared completely dormant. Wikipedia and BBC Monitoring both list it as defunct.
Defunct. And yet Newsweek, 5 days ago, lists smaller ISIS cells operating in Sinai alongside Libya and Tunisia, and the NSC still puts the whole peninsula at level 4. So, which is it?
The estimate I've seen from ISS has the group down to about 500 fighters last year, from a peak of around 1,500 in 2015. That's not nothing, but it's not an insurgency either. 500 people scattered across a peninsula that's 60,000 square kilometers, mostly desert, mostly in the northeast. The honest framing is that the formal wilayat structure is assessed dormant or defunct, with residual low-level cells possible and unclaimed attacks possible. What I couldn't find is any confirmed major attack in Sinai in 2025 or 2026. The last significant documented incidents were in 2023. A police compound clash in Erish in July, an IED that killed 7 soldiers in September. Since then, quiet, or what passes for quiet in a heavily restricted media environment.
That caveat matters more than usual here. Egypt controls the narrative in North Sinai. Journalists don't roam freely. If a small attack happens and the army doesn't want it reported, we may simply never hear about it. So the absence of documented attacks in the last 2 years could mean genuine quiet, or it could mean reporting gaps. We can't tell from outside.
Right. And the NSC advisory itself is interesting because the council explicitly said this doesn't constitute a new set of travel warnings. Sinai has been at level 4 for years. This is a reaffirmation ahead of the holidays, not an escalation. The timing is about Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot, when Israelis flood across the Taba crossing. Peak holiday season can see 100,000 travelers per day through Ben-Gurion. A lot of them head to Sinai.
The Taba crossing is one of Egypt's busiest, and the visa arrangement is unusual. Israelis enter Sinai visa-free for up to 14 days if they enter only through Taba or Sharm el-Sheikh Airport. There's also the Sinai only stamp, free, valid, up to 15 days, covering only South Sinai, not Cairo, not Luxor, not Hurghada. A full visa is $25 for the visa or $30 at the airport. So the Egyptian government has created a frictionless corridor for Israelis to spend money in South Sinai while keeping them out of the rest of the country.
And that corridor has never been touched by the insurgency. That's the tourism paradox Daniel's circling. The fighting concentrated in the northeast. Erish, Sheikh Zuwaid, Rafah, South Sinai, where Sharm, Dahab, Nuwaiba, Taba all sit, never saw the insurgency spread. The bombings, the battles, the mosque massacre, all hundreds of kilometers from the beach resorts. Yet the entire peninsula gets a blanket level 4 warning. Israelis' Red Sea holidays are collateral damage of a threat concentrated far away.
100,000 travelers per day at the airport, and the NSC is telling them all Sinai is as dangerous as Somaliland. That's a strange map to hold in your head. You can be sitting on a beach in Dahab, 2 hours from Taba, and the security services in Jerusalem are saying you're in a must-avoid zone. Meanwhile, the actual threat is up near Rafah, where you'd need a military convoy to get anywhere near.
The geography is the thing Daniel's really pushing at, though. He says it's the type of place where those with familiarity from birth are at a significant advantage. Does the survival of extremist groups owe to long-standing roots in the region, even as nomads?
The answer is yes, but with a complication. The insurgency didn't start as foreign fighters coming in. It started with local Bedouin tribesmen who exploited the chaos after the 2011 revolution. The Economist reporting on this is blunt. Local armed Bedouins have long-standing grievances against the central government in Cairo. They're barred from joining the army or police. They find it hard to get jobs in tourism. They complain that many of their lands have been taken from them.
That's the grievance economics. South Sinai resorts are the peninsula's sole economic assets, but locals reportedly benefit minimally. Cairo reserves land and jobs for Nile Delta migrants. So you have a local population that sees the tourist money flowing past them, that can't join the security forces, that's lost land. The combination of harsh terrain and lack of resources kept the area poor and ripe for militancy. That's not my phrasing, that's the assessment that keeps showing up.
And the terrain itself is a force multiplier. The Sinai is 60,000 square kilometers of mountains, desert, wadis, and coastline. Somebody who grew up there knows where the water is, where the passes are, where you can move a vehicle without being seen. Somebody flown in from Cairo or trained in Libya doesn't. The insurgency's early success was built on local knowledge, smuggling routes that had existed for generations, weapons and supplies moving through the same paths Bedouin traders had used for centuries.
The 1979 peace treaty made it worse. It mandated a diminished security presence in parts of Sinai, which enabled militants to operate with a freer hand. So the geography plus the treaty plus the grievances created the conditions. But here's the complication Daniel's question needs. The same tribes also fought ISIS.
That's the part that breaks the simple nomads equals militants story.
The Sinai Tribal Union fought alongside Egyptian forces. The Al-Tarabin tribe attacked Ansar Beit al-Maqdis positions in Rafah in April 2015 after the group killed a tribal member. When ISIS started killing Bedouin leaders, executing people for cooperating with the army, the tribes turned. And that's when the insurgency really started losing. The local knowledge that had sustained it became local knowledge arrayed against it.
So the survival of whatever remains isn't just about knowing the terrain. It's about whether the tribes see the government as a worse enemy than the jihadis. Right now, the army is running outreach to tribal leaders, meeting with Sinai and Matru tribal leaders over development needs. The East Canal counter-terrorism forces and the Western military region both involved. Egypt's strategy is explicitly to remove the environment that extremist organizations may exploit, development projects alongside military action.
And that's the long game. If Bedouin kids can get jobs, if their families see tourism revenue, if they're allowed into the police and army, the recruitment pool dries up. But those grievances are decades old. The Economist piece about barring Bedouins from the army and police, that wasn't from 2015. That's a structural complaint that predates the insurgency and hasn't been resolved. The amnesty program got some fighters to lay down arms, but amnesty doesn't create jobs.
What does the current moment look like on the ground, though? If I'm an Israeli considering driving down to Dahab for Sukkot, what am I actually walking into?
If you stay in South Sinai, you're walking into a heavily policed tourist corridor that hasn't seen an attack linked to the insurgency. The Taba crossing is fortified. The road down the coast is patrolled. Sharm has its own security apparatus built up after the Metrojet bombing in 2015, which, by the way, was a bomb at the airport that killed 224 people, mostly Russians. That attack changed everything about airport security in Egypt. But it didn't happen in the northeast. It happened at the tourist hub. So the threat model in South Sinai isn't the Bedouin insurgency. It's the possibility of a single operative getting through.
That's the NSC's actual language. Unpredictable and decentralized threat. Ideological radicalization from worsening anti-Israel discourse online. Attackers who act independently, usually against soft and accessible targets. 25 Israelis and Jews have been killed abroad in lone wolf attacks since October 7, 2023. The advisory isn't really about ISIS, Sinai as an organization. It's about the individual who sees a group of Israelis at a beach cafe and decides to act.
And that changes how you assess the risk. The formal insurgency is defunct or dormant. The residual cells, if they exist, are in the northeast and focused on Egyptian security forces. But the lone wolf threat is everywhere, including places with no organized ISIS presence at all. The NSC is warning about a threat model, not a specific group in a specific location.
Which brings us back to the level 4 blanket. If the threat is lone wolves anywhere, why does Sinai get the same rating as Somaliland? Partly it's about capacity to respond. If something happens in Dahab, the Israeli consular response is slower than in Athens or Rome. Partly it's about the border. Taba is a land crossing. Evacuation by road in a crisis is harder than getting to an airport.
And partly it's about the legal situation. Israelis are legally barred from traveling to Iraq, Yemen, Iran, Syria, and Lebanon. Saudi Arabia, Bangladesh, Somalia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Libya, and Algeria are also high risk. Egypt is in a strange middle category. It's a country Israel has a peace treaty with, a country Israelis visit in large numbers, and yet the NSC says the whole thing is level 4. The advisory is doing political work as much as security work.
The CASS analysis adds another layer. Sinai's security is now inseparable from the Gaza War, the Red Sea, Sudan, and Libya. The peninsula is a pivot for managing humanitarian aid movement and border security, with concerns about smuggling networks or extremist elements exploiting regional turmoil. So even if the local insurgency is dead, Sinai is hostage to everything happening around it. A flare-up in Gaza, a collapse in Sudan, Houthi activity in the Red Sea, any of those could destabilize the peninsula.
And the Gaza border at Rafah is the sharpest edge. Egypt shares that border. The smuggling tunnels that used to run under it were a major revenue source for groups in North Sinai. When the tunnels were flooded and destroyed, a lot of the local economy went with them. That's part of why the tribes turned against ISIS. The Egyptian army's crackdown on smuggling hurt everyone, and ISIS's response was to kill tribal leaders. The tribes chose the army over the jihadis, but they didn't get their economy back.
So what does Egypt's control actually look like in 2026? I'd say the army has physical control of the northeast in a way it didn't in 2015. It can move troops, it can hold towns, it can run checkpoints. What it doesn't have is the kind of soft control that makes insurgencies impossible to restart. Development is slow, grievances are old, and the region is surrounded by instability. The formal insurgency is over. The conditions that produced it are not.
That's the honest summary. And Daniel's question about nomadic roots, the answer is that local knowledge cut both ways. It sustained the insurgency in the early years, then it helped destroy the insurgency when the tribes flipped. The survival of residual cells now is less about birth familiarity with terrain and more about the sheer size of the desert and the limits of any security force to police every wadi. The Cass language about the expanse of desert zones providing an environment for reorganization is really about that. You can't occupy 60,000 square kilometers. You can patrol it, you can surveil it, but there will always be places you don't see.
And the people who know those places best are the same people the government has spent decades alienating. So the question isn't whether ISIS Sinai is defunct. It's whether the next group, whatever it calls itself, finds the same recruitment pool waiting.
The IISS number, 500 fighters, down from 1,500. That's a remnant, not a movement. But remnants don't need to win battles. They need to survive until conditions shift. A regional shock, a political crisis in Cairo, a breakdown in the tribal outreach. Any of those could give the remnant room to grow. The NSC's Level 4 is really saying, we don't trust that the conditions have changed enough to bet Israeli lives on it.
And yet, Israelis will go. They always do. The high holidays come, the Taba crossing fills up, and thousands of families drive down to Dahab because it's cheap, it's close, and the water is beautiful. The advisory says, avoid. The people say, book the hotel.
There's a psychological dimension there. Israelis have a complicated relationship with risk. The same person who won't drive through certain neighborhoods in Jerusalem at night will happily camp on a Sinai beach. Partly, it's familiarity. Sinai has been the Israeli vacation spot for decades. The peace treaty made it accessible, and the visa arrangement made it easy. That familiarity breeds a sense of safety that may not match the threat picture.
The Metrojet bombing should have shattered that. 224 people dead because a bomb got into the airport at Sharm. But tourism recovered. The mosque massacre should have made Israelis think twice about the peninsula as a whole. But the response was mostly, that's up north, we're going to Dahab. There's a compartmentalization that lets people hold the warning and the beach trip in their heads at the same time.
The visa stamp is the part nobody thinks about.
How do you mean?
You cross at Taba, they stamp your passport for Sinai only. 14 days. That stamp means if something goes wrong up north, if the army closes the road, you're stuck in a strip of coast with one way out. I worked a season at a dive shop in Nuweiba in the late 90s. The stamp was the same then. Tourists thought it was about keeping them out of Cairo. It was also about knowing exactly where they were.
That's a sharper point than it first sounds. The Sinai-only stamp isn't just a convenience, it's a tracking mechanism. The Egyptian government knows precisely how many Israelis are in South Sinai at any moment, because every one of them entered through a controlled crossing with a restricted stamp. If there's an incident, the response is faster. If there's a need to evacuate, the numbers are already known.
And the flip side is that the stamp also limits where you can go. If you're in Dahab and something happens in Cairo, you can't just drive to the airport in the capital. You have to go back through Taba. The geography of the visa is the geography of the risk.
My question is whether the stamp would let you get to St. Catherine's Monastery.
St. Catherine's is in South Sinai. It's within the stamp zone. Why?
I've been thinking about the manuscripts. They've got the oldest continuously operating library in the world up there. If the peninsula destabilizes again, what happens to that collection?
That's a real question. St. Catherine's is a UNESCO site, one of the oldest Christian monasteries in the world, and its library holds manuscripts that exist nowhere else. The monastery is in the mountains, inland from Dahab. The insurgency never got near it, but the concern in a destabilized Sinai would be exactly the kind of looting and smuggling that's happened in other conflict zones. The Bedouin who live around the monastery have historically protected it. That's another case where local knowledge and local relationships matter more than military control.
And it's another reason the Level 4 blanket is too blunt. The threat to a tourist beach and the threat to a mountain monastery are different. The threat to an Israeli family in Dahab and the threat to an Egyptian checkpoint in Arish are different. But the advisory has to be simple enough to act on, so everything gets flattened.
The dive shop owner in Nuweiba used to say, "The desert doesn't care who you are." I think about that line more than I should.
He's not wrong. The terrain that protects a smuggler protects a monk, protects a tourist who gets lost. It's neutral. The question is always who knows it better.
That's where Daniel's intuition lands. The people who know it best are the ones who've been there for generations, the Bedouin tribes. Whether they're protecting a monastery, running a dive shop, or fighting the army, their knowledge is the thing every outside power has to work around. Egypt can't govern Sinai without them. ISIS couldn't hold it without them. The tourists can't enjoy it without them.
Which is why the tribal outreach matters more than the military operations. The army could kill every remaining ISIS fighter tomorrow, and the underlying problem wouldn't change. The tribes need a reason to stay aligned with Cairo. Jobs, land rights, a share of the tourism revenue. That's the long-term stabilization, and it's the part that's hardest to verify from outside. We can count fighters, we can't count grievances.
Where does that leave Daniel's question about whether Egypt has solidified stable control? I'd say the control is real, but conditional. The army holds the northeast. The insurgency is dormant or defunct. The tourist corridor is functioning. But the conditions that produce the insurgency are still there, and the regional picture is worse than it was 5 years ago. Gaza, Sudan, the Red Sea. Sinai's stability is borrowed against all of it.
The ISIS question has a clear answer. The formal branch, Wilayat Sinai, is assessed defunct by the most authoritative trackers. The NCTC says decline since 2022. IISS has the numbers down to 500. But Newsweek still lists smaller cells, and the NSC still rates the peninsula level 4. The honest framing is that there's no named active ISIS, Sinai organization with a confirmed operational presence in 2026. There are residual cells, possible low-level activity, and a lot of uncertainty. The formal structure is gone. The ideology and the grievances are not.
The 25 Israelis and Jews killed abroad since October 7th. That's the number that should focus the mind. The NSC isn't warning about an army. It's warning about individuals. The lone wolf who sees a group of Israelis and acts. That threat doesn't need an organization. It needs a motive and an opportunity. And Sinai offers both, because it's full of soft targets, and it's a place where Israelis gather predictably.
Predictably is the key word. Every holiday season, the same crossing, the same road, the same beaches. If you wanted to find Israelis outside Israel, Sinai is one of the easiest places to do it. The advisory knows that. The level 4 is really saying, we know you love this place, and that's exactly why it's dangerous.
I keep coming back to the strangeness of it. A peace treaty, a visa-free corridor, decades of family vacations, and a level 4 warning. Both things true at once. Egypt and Israel have a cold peace, but it's a peace that includes a steady flow of Israeli tourists into Egyptian territory. That's not nothing, and the warning doesn't cancel it. It just adds a layer of official anxiety to a trip that millions of Israelis have made without incident.
The peace treaty itself created the vulnerability. The demilitarized zones, the restricted Egyptian security presence, those were designed to prevent another war. They also created space for the insurgency to grow. So the very framework that made Sinai safe for Israeli tourism also made it harder for Egypt to police the peninsula. That's the paradox at the center of all of this.
The solution Egypt has found is to remilitarize with Israeli consent. The treaty's limitations have been quietly adjusted over the years. Egyptian troops moved into the northeast to fight the insurgency, with coordination from Jerusalem. So the cold peace is flexible enough to let Egypt fight its internal war. That's a form of stability that doesn't show up in the NSC advisory.
The dive shop closed in 2001. Owner said the tourists stopped coming after the Intifada. I wonder if he'd recognize the place now.
The South Sinai coast has built up a lot since the 90s, Sharm especially. But Nuweiba and Dahab still have that low-rise backpacker feel, the kind of place where you sleep in a hut on the beach and the power goes out at midnight. The insurgency never touched it, but the tourism economy has been through shocks. The Metrojet bombing, the pandemic, the Gaza war, every regional crisis empties the beaches for a while, then they fill back up.
Because the water is still there. The mountains are still there. The cheap fish and the coral reefs and the desert nights. That's what Daniel means when he says it's geographically breathtaking. The security situation changes, the geography doesn't, and people keep coming back to the geography.
The question is whether the next decade looks like the last one. If Egypt's development push works, if the tribes stay aligned, if the regional shocks don't cascade, Sinai could become more stable than it's been in a generation. If any of those fail, the remnant cells have room to grow. The desert doesn't care. It'll be there either way.
The Israelis will be there either way too, level 4 or not. The Taba crossing will be busy this Sukkot. Some people will read the advisory and cancel. Most will read it and go anyway. That's the thing about a warning that's been level 4 for years. It becomes background noise. The urgency fades even if the threat doesn't.
The NSC said this isn't a new set of warnings. That's almost an admission that the level 4 has lost its power. If you tell people every year that the place they love is dangerous, and every year they go and come back fine, the warning stops meaning anything. That's a real problem for the security establishment. How do you maintain credibility when the danger is real but low probability?
You lean on the lone wolf framing, the unpredictable, decentralized threat. That's harder to dismiss because it doesn't depend on a specific group being active. It just says, there are people out there who want to kill you, and they're hard to spot. That's true everywhere. Sinai is just a place where Israelis cluster.
That's the honest answer to Daniel's prompt. Egypt has solidified control over the formal insurgency. The ISIS branch is defunct or dormant. The tribes are mostly aligned with Cairo. The tourist corridor is functioning. But the peninsula is huge, the grievances are old, the region is unstable, and the lone wolf threat is everywhere. Level 4 is a judgment call, not a mathematical certainty. It says the risk is high enough that the state won't bless your beach trip. It can't stop you from going. It can only tell you that if something happens, they told you so.
The nomadic roots question. I think the answer is that roots matter, but they're not destiny. The Bedouin tribes produce both the insurgency and its defeat. The terrain that protected militants also protects the monastery and the tourist. The knowledge that makes someone dangerous also makes them indispensable. Egypt's control, such as it is, depends on keeping the tribes on side. That's not a military fact. It's a political one. And it's the thing the level 4 warning can't capture.
What the warning captures is the gap between what Egypt claims and what the NSC believes. Sisi says terrorism is over. The NSC says avoid the place. Both can be right in different ways. The formal war is over. The residual risk is real. The beach is beautiful. The desert is dangerous. All of it true at once.
That's the weirdness of Sinai. It's a vacation spot, and a war zone, a peace treaty success, and a security failure. A place where the same tribes that fought ISIS now run the dive shops and guard the roads. Daniel's right that it's the kind of place where local knowledge is everything. And the people with that knowledge have been there longer than any of the armies, any of the governments, any of the warnings.
The next time the NSC updates this, I'd watch for one thing. Whether the language shifts from residual cells to something more specific. If they start naming a new group, that means the remnant found room to grow. If they keep saying level 4 without specifics, that's the sound of a warning that's become a habit.
The sound of 100,000 travelers ignoring it, which is its own kind of answer to Daniel's question. The people who know Sinai best, the Israelis who've been going for decades, they've already made their risk calculation. The state disagrees. The beach doesn't care. We'll see who's right.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the desk running and for the dive shop memory. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com if you've got a Sinai story or a prompt for us to dig into. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.